Welcome to the Background Briefing podcast. This week, is clean coal a false promise? The Abbott government's direct action policy to combat climate change is now through the Senate, thanks to the support of the Palmer United Party and two independents. A central plank of direct action is a plan to clean up emissions from coal-fired power stations using a yet-to-be-proven technology. It's an ambitious plan in light of the latest IPCC review, which says the burning of fossil fuels has helped drive greenhouse gases to the highest levels in 800,000 years. In this program, first broadcast in July, Background Briefing guest reporter Paddy Manning, who's business editor at Crikey, investigated the checkered history of clean coal technology and asked whether the government is pinning too much hope on it.
Clean coal. It's the key to a low emissions future for one of Australia's largest export industries and a linchpin of the government's plan to slow climate change. So get ready to hear more claims like this from Environment Minister Greg Hunt about cleaning up our coal-fired power stations.
The technology which is emerging now, and which I think will be available over the next 3 to 5 years, cleans up very significantly, not perfectly, but very significantly, by up to 30 to 50% the emissions from current generation.
What the minister's talking about here is the direct injection carbon engine being developed by the CSIRO.
Direct injection carbon engine. How cool does that sound? I want one of them.
A modified diesel, the direct injection carbon engine runs on a 50-50 mixture of coal and water, known as a slurry. Coal water slurries are not new. They've been researched for more than 30 years in Australia. But after tens of millions of dollars of taxpayer funds have been poured in, all we have to show for it is a prototype single-cylinder diesel engine sitting on a bench at a CSIRO shed in Newcastle. When it's running, this is what it sounds like. Background Briefing today poses the question, why is the government making such grand claims for a technology still stuck in the lab? Meet Ted Pickering, a former New South Wales Energy Minister and lifetime anti-corruption campaigner. Ted has been hearing stories about turning clean coal into a liquid fuel for decades. First it was called super coal, then it was ultra clean coal. Now it's a micronized refined coal. Whatever you call it, it hasn't delivered yet. Ted Pickering wants to know why the CSIRO is still involved.
You go to any expert in the field and say, you know, can you run a diesel engine on 50% water and 50% coal? And they look at you as if you're slightly mad. But when you then tell them that this is backed up by the CSIRO, they very quickly go to water. No one wants to say publicly, oh, you know, that's madness, because the CSIRO is involved.
Back in March, Ted sent a detailed report to the CSIRO, challenging them to justify their long-standing and continuing support for this research, which he believes is fundamentally flawed.
So you're not shy of a fight?
No, I'm not shy of a fight. I've been a robust character in my time. I tend to call a shovel a shovel.
Background Briefing estimates that over the last 30 years, state and federal governments, the CSIRO and various private companies have tipped at least $120 million into the quest to use coal as a liquid fuel. The results have been underwhelming. CSIRO stands by the research, however, insisting there has been progress and years of effort could soon pay off. Energy theme leader Dr. Jim Smitham says rising oil and gas prices will create new opportunities.
I think this has high potential. In the 1970s and early 80s, when oil prices shot up and people were worried about oil supply, there was a lot of work done around the world looking at coal water slurries, and some of that looked at coal water slurries in diesel engines. The Department of Energy in the US did a major program, demonstrated technical feasibility. The oil market changed and it never progressed to commercial application. We're looking at similar situations today of rising energy prices, the opportunity for coal to be used in a new way and far more efficiently to reduce emissions. And the diesel engine is a highly developed piece of technology that provided the injection system can be modified to take a cold water slurry. It will burn quite efficiently and provide that new market opportunity.
Continued funding for these programs contrasts with the cuts handed out to the renewable energy sector by the Abbott government. In the recent federal budget, renewable energy programs were cut nearly twice as hard as clean coal programs. And since the budget, new clean coal grants have been announced.
There's 500 years of highly polluting brown coal in the Latrobe Valley. Two companies have been funded to try to transform it into clean energy.
Industry Minister Ian McFarlane recently announced new Commonwealth state grants worth $75 million, and some of that money will make coal water fuel for the direct injection carbon engine program out of Victoria's massive brown coal reserves.
Ignite Energy Resources will receive $20 million to trial the production of synthetic crude oil and coal slurry. Coal Energy
Australia. It was great news for Ignite Energy. John White, a founding shareholder of Ignite, chairs a network of companies and government bodies who've teamed up with CSIRO to develop and fund the direct injection carbon engine. He says the technology could be the perfect complement to renewable energy, and the federal government is very supportive.
Minister Greg Hunt and Minister Ian McFarlane for Energy are very interested in DICE because it offers the opportunity of reducing CO2 emissions for electricity from brown coal by 50%, and it offers the opportunity to reduce CO2 emissions from black coals by around 30%.
Not everyone's convinced. Environment writer Bob Burton says while a 50% cut in emissions sounds big, it's not nearly enough.
Let's take those figures at face value. A 50% cut would get brown coal back roughly to where black coal is. And what the science is telling us is that we have to have substantial cuts in greenhouse gas emissions and rapidly. This is a technology that doesn't exist in the real world at a commercial scale. There's no guarantee that it ever will. So pouring public funds into a technology that at best is uncertain and equally at best is only going to get us back to where black coal is pretty irrelevant.
Bob Burton's not the only one asking questions. Energy consultant Bruce Mountain can't see how the direct injection carbon engine can compete in today's electricity market.
You know, it is progress against history. It is progress against the existing brown coal plant. But there's been much more progress in other technologies. So, you know, you'd say, well, it's great that it's moved on from the old plant, but so what? The rest of the world has moved on more quickly. And as a cost of electricity, it is no cheaper and indeed seems to be more expensive. So quite why a private investor or lender would be attracted to it is not at all clear to me.
Research into the use of coal water fuel started in earnest in Australia during the oil shock of the 1970s. That was when Travis Duncan, also known as Mr. Coal, and his company White Industries got a mining lease at Ulan in the Upper Hunter Valley.
And that was a mine outside Mudgee that had about 15 guys working in it. It was the last mine in New South Wales that still had horses. It had two horses, one called Mary and one called Harry. The horses went round and round in circles and wound up the endless rope and pulled the little banana carts of coal out of the mine.
The mine at Ulan gave Duncan, now in his 80s, coal to work with. Duncan and his partner, company founder, the late Jeff White, went to the US and found scientists trialling coal water as a replacement for diesel to be used in trucks and trains. He was amazed.
I said, bloody hell, this looks good, you know, put your hand in it and got stuff all over your fingers and that. And we thought, this coal water stuff looks good.
Coal water?
Coal and water mixed together so that you could use it to burn as handle it like oil and burn it like oil in big diesel engines.
Is this where the idea started?
This is where the idea started.
It was a big idea. Duncan could see a whole new market for Australia's enormous coal reserves as a liquid fuel, cheaper than oil.
So we came back and spoke to the CSIRO, and we put about $58,000 into the CSIRO for seed money for him to do some work for us, to look at coal water.
An even more ambitious plan was to use the coal water fuel in gas turbines.
It then turned out that the Americans at Fisherman's Bend, at the end of the First World War, at their research works there, had used coal in an aircraft turbine engine, but it had seriously eroded the blades.
The challenge was to remove the ash, the non-combustible mineral matter within the coal that was wrecking the engines.
So their work came up that said, if you can get the coal where the ash is low enough and the size of the ash that's left in there is small enough, you'll be able to run turbines on coal.
Yeah, I've seen that and thought, geez, that's fanciful, isn't it?
No, that's right.
Right.
Okay, so we then started working on removing ash from the coal with the CSIRO.
At about this time, Ted Pickering joined the Liberal Party and decided to run for state parliament. A qualified coal engineer, Ted had started his career at the BHP Steelworks in Newcastle. As he showed background briefing around his home in Wollongong, it was clear he's still proud of his coal industry beginnings.
Well, one of the ones I'm most proudest of is a picture here of a coal preparation plant that I designed from the floor up, the Mount Thorley coal preparation plant in the Hunter Valley. It's probably the most complex coal preparation plant in Australia, and it has the record of being the first to be completely controlled by computer. You just hit a button and the whole place starts up itself by computer.
Pickering was elected to the New South Wales Upper House in 1976 when the late Neville Wran became Premier. He was soon made Shadow Energy spokesman and made good use of his contacts in the coal industry. One day, he got a tip-off.
Well, Paddy, I received the most unusual phone call from a very senior bureaucrat who came from a department related to energy matters in New South Wales.
The bureaucrat told him that the state government was about to gift a giant coal lease at Yulan to a company that had a top secret program to produce a super coal by blasting coal at bullet-like speeds in a stream of hot air, smashing it finer than talcum powder. Documents seen by background briefing show the government's own bureaucrats were sceptical and insisted that an exploration lease was not necessary to develop this clean coal process. But the company, Energy Recycling Corporation, had support from the Premier.
The government was supporting this company by giving them an exceedingly large coal exploration licence. It was 100 square miles, which was twice the size of an ordinary coal exploration licence. They were about to give that licence to this company simply on the basis that this company was alleging they had this so-called super coal process, which they were keeping secret from everyone.
The company claimed the patented clean coal technology had huge export potential. They were given a 2-year exploration lease at Yulan in 1979. They boasted that major US power companies were on their way to Sydney to buy up super coal, and markets were sure to open up in Japan and Europe.
Because it had no ash in it and was very fine, at this time, they were suggesting two things they could do with it. One was that they could use it to fire coal for power generation using existing power plants. The other suggestion was that they could use this coal to fire diesel engines. So, in effect, keep in mind that at this stage we're in the world energy crisis, we were running out of oil, the OPEC crisis was occurring, prices of oil was jumping up. There was a genuine crisis in the world at this time. And so they had this concept that they could turn the world's coal resources into oil.
Would have been an enormous achievement if they could have pulled it off.
It would have been a bonanza. I mean, it would have meant Australia would have become the new Arabia of the world. And indeed, the financial, commercial implications of this process, if it worked, were nothing less than enormous. I mean, absolutely enormous.
But the story that sounded too good to be true was too good to be true. Pickering exposed Energy Recycling's links to share market manipulation in the United States. The company was being investigated by the FBI over bribery allegations there, and the Australian Federal Police were involved. At one point, they supplied Pickering with a raft of FBI documents. It turned out that the claims for the Supercoal technology were fraudulent. Stung into action, the government sent inspectors up to the Hunter Valley to see how the pilot plant was going.
No pilot plant actually existed, and the New South Wales government had given this lease on the basis that they would produce a full-scale plant by a certain time, and when that certain time arrived, there was no plant anywhere. The whole thing was actually a joke.
The RAND government revoked the lease. It was an embarrassing moment.
And you assumed at that point that you'd had a victory and Supercoal was done.
Yeah, of course. That's exactly what I thought. I thought, well, that's over and done with, thank goodness. But unfortunately, that was not to be the case.
5 years later, after RAND resigned as Premier and quit politics, one of his first appointments was as Chairman of the CSIRO. To Ted Pickering's astonishment, the Supercoal idea was soon revived.
Shortly after that appointment, I think about 12 months or so, the Chairman of the CSIRO, Mr. Ram, makes an announcement on a Christmas Eve that the CSIRO have developed a new Supercoal program.
It's coming back.
It's coming back. This time it's now known as the Ultra Clean Coal.
RAND called Ultra Clean Coal a marvellous Christmas present from the CSIRO to the Australian coal industry. Here he is speaking at the press club in 1988.
Next to wool, coal is our biggest export earner. CSIRO scientists have recently completed research and development leading to a new ultra clean coal which has the potential to create a whole new export market for Australian coal and boost the value of our coal exports by several hundred million dollars a year.
The CSIRO had formed a joint venture with White Industries where Travis Duncan and other industry partners would beaver away on ultra-clean coal for the next 20 years, trialling a new chemical cleaning process to leach the ash out. As Duncan recalls...
CSIRO came up with an idea of how to do it, and we built a pilot plant in the old power station at Ulan. And it was a pretty crude bloody plant. But we did achieve the reduction of the ash from about 14% down to between 1.5% and 2%. We then did more work with the CSIRO and we built three more pilot plants. And we got better every time.
Serious public money came their way in 2000 when former Industry Minister Nick Minchin gave White Industries $13.5 million to build another pilot plant at Cessnock in the Lower Hunter Valley. The New South Wales government again contributed land worth about $2 million, and CSIRO scientists were seconded to the scheme. Success didn't come easily. In fact, it didn't come at all. But Duncan didn't give up.
What's going on in all this over, you know, 20, 30 years is... gradual refinement, is it, or is there any breakthroughs, or is there any...
No, there's not a big breakthrough. They are step by step, you know. Each time we did it, we learnt things each time we did it.
And we implemented them. It seems like there's so many pilot plants, really, that you've probably mentioned maybe half a dozen, you know.
But all different processes.
I mean, do you at any point go, oh, I'll give up, this is not working?
No, because it is working. It's... Of course, there's bloody discouraging exercises in there, you know.
Yeah.
But each time along the way, you improve the process, and like when we're first trying to bloody promote it, there was not a lot of enthusiasm.
Maybe not, but there was plenty of enthusiasm for the coal at Ulan, which would go from a neglected underground mine to a massive open cut and underground complex that was sold to Exxon in 1989. And a decade later, onto Xstrata. Long-time local residents like landholder Bev Smiles have watched the huge coal mines spread through the Mudgee district and have been trying to piece together how all the mines got approved.
Well, that's been the problem from a community perspective, is sort of tracking what's going on behind the scenes with all of these deals that can completely impact on a wide area of the community.
Smiles watched as the clean coal technologies became a feature in White Industries' mining leases granted throughout the valley. She wondered if there was a pattern.
Well, there definitely has been around this concept of them developing up an ultra-clean coal project, which would then help the coal industry produce energy with less carbon dioxide emissions. That was the justification for the project.
It all became clear when Bev got her hands on the exploration licence for the giant Moolarben mine across the river from Ulan. It spelt out that the explorer had to develop an ultra-clean coal demonstration plant there. White had used their technology to get their foot in the door and win the tender at Moolarben.
While it was a condition of the exploration licence, no one has, in government, has required that condition to be met in any way. It just disappeared once the mine was approved.
And did it give them an edge in the tender process for that exploration licence, having this clean coal project they were trumpeting?
Well, it definitely did, and we were quite suspicious, actually, at the time when the licence was granted and with the conditions in the licence and the fact that they had a project, pilot project, happening in the Cessnock area. The Minister for Mining at the time was Kerry Hickey, who was the local member for Cessnock. There seemed to be quite a close tie between what was happening with their project and White Industries being the successful tenderer.
In 2004, Travis Duncan's company won the exploration lease. It would make him rich. Bev smiles.
Well, just winning the tender for that exploration licence, or any exploration licence for that fact, is money in the bank, because it's very rare for a mine not to be approved and go ahead in New South Wales.
4 years later, Travis Duncan was still talking up the ultra-clean coal, saying it could be sold in the US at half the price of natural gas. It was a stunning claim. Ted Pickering.
When White Industries can write an extensive report where they show tables that they've produced this ultra-clean coal in their pilot plant at a commercial rate so that the coal is half the cost of natural gas, then that alone would indicate that we have a huge advantage here for our coal industry, which will supplement natural gas. It hasn't happened. One wonders why.
With coal prices booming, China's state-owned mining giant Yanzhou bought Travis Duncan's company Felix Resources for $3 billion in 2009. But the Chinese placed no value at all on the ultra-clean coal technology that came with the deal. Last year, after trialling the fuel on a pair of old train engines, they suspended the program and decommissioned the Cessnock plant. Yan Zhao would not be interviewed for this story. Travis Duncan made a cool $500 million on the sale of Felix, catapulting him up the rich list. His personal wealth now is $665 million. Duncan's next move was through a company called Cascade Coal, which had its foot on a tenement at Mount Penny in the nearby Byalong Valley. That deal landed Duncan in hot water with the New South Wales Independent Commission Against Corruption, which was investigating the affairs of former Labor politician Eddie Obeid. Duncan was found to have behaved corruptly, but is challenging those findings in court. Travis Duncan held on to another clean coal technology invented by the CSIRO and part funded by the taxpayer, binderless coal briquetting. The technology, which had a grant from Ian Macfarlane worth $4 million, created briquettes just like heat beads that would be used to export the ultra-clean coal. It was a disaster, costing White Energy more than $100 million when an Indonesian project unravelled. At the company's 2012 AGM, chaired by Travis Duncan, one shareholder let fly.
Please make your comment.
Okay, yes. So we're down to this $100 million. So should there be some sort of, at least some sort of meeting by the directors to consider what are the alternatives for the company? So are we going to, it's conceivable we go ahead and spend the $100 million on this coal technology. What could happen is, and we know the history, we're going to lose the $100 million. So can we have somebody like a chartered accountant or somebody could advise what are the alternatives of the company at this stage where we could somehow possibly make a profit for the shareholders, pay a dividend somewhere along the line here for the shareholders? You know, could, for example, could the company be converted to a listed investment company where it invests in different projects? Could it, you know, I'm just giving ideas. I have no idea. Could the...
That is obvious.
Yep. Could the company, you know, do some sort of deal with a backdoor listing where somehow we could increase the value of the company significantly by doing some other deal? Or could we look at other technology? Could we look at something to make a profit for the shareholders, to pay a dividend for the shareholders? Couldn't we have somebody give, a chartered accountant or somebody give us some ideas as to what alternatives we've got? Because we're now down to $100 million. I think we had $300 or $400 million before.
I think you are incorrectly wrong.
Sorry, okay, well, whatever it was. But we're really down now, and $100 million, if you...
You keep repeating the $100 million,
It's a lot of money. It's a lot of money. And if we're going to do it in, that's really
excuse,
bad.
Excuse me, please. I understand your point that we are down to $100 million in cash, but I would draw attention to you that the gentlemen sitting at this table have contributed more than $100 million in cash into the company, and they are not the sort of people who will willy-nilly dispose of that money without due consideration.
While Duncan and White Energy carry on briquetting, the CSIRO is keeping the coal water dream alive. A new lab has been built at Newcastle, with $3 million scraped together to run a micronised refined coal produced through a new physical cleaning process through direct injection carbon engines, modified versions of the large diesels used in ships. Lead CSIRO scientist Dr. Lewis Wibberley explained it all to ABC Newcastle's Paul Bevan.
Can you tell us about the direct injection carbon engine? How does this work?
It's really quite simple. It's a large diesel engine that's been modified to enable the use of a slurry fuel. The slurry fuel, which we call micronized refined carbon, is a slurry containing black or brown coals or biomass. So it's a water-based slurry. It looks a lot like black water-based paint, acrylic paint, so it's quite thick. It looks like a heavy fuel oil, and it burns like a heavy fuel oil in a large engine.
So you're basically taking coal and turning it into a liquid fuel?
Yes, but not by chemical processing. It's all by a simple physical processing route, which already exists. And you're burning a suspension of coal or biomass or any other solid carbon. It's suspended in water. So it's a slurry, just like paint is.
Okay. I didn't know paint was a slurry, to tell you the truth, but now I do. There's something else we've learned.
Background Briefing toured CSIRO's lab at Newcastle and was shown the breakthrough mill used to grind the coal, the flotation cell used to separate the ash out, and the coal water slurry fuel itself. We saw the 3.9-litre diesel engine used in the trials and the combustion chamber with a high-speed video camera to record the explosions as the fuel's injected. The CSIRO scientists say the coal water fuel burns amazingly well, but admit there's a degree of industry scepticism to overcome. And potential showstoppers loom if engine wear or fouling proves worse than expected in trials in Japan next year. Dr. Jim Smitham says you can't judge the current research based on past failures.
I think it's important to know, though, that science and research is not a continuous process. You know, we haven't worked on this continuously over 30 years. As markets change, as companies' attitude to risk changes, as new ideas in research change, then old ideas get revisited. And Diesel's original patent was looking at coal-fired diesels in the late 1800s. So, you know, I think ideas come and go. They drift in and out of being feasible. And at the present time, I think it is worthwhile looking again at this option for providing coal with a low emissions future that it doesn't have if it only relies on combustion.
The Prime Minister Tony Abbott certainly believes coal has a long future ahead of it.
For many decades at least, coal will continue to fuel human progress as an affordable, dependable energy source for wealthy and developing countries alike. I want to repeat that. Coal will continue to fuel human progress.
If Tony Abbott's hopes for the coal industry are to be realised, that can only be through clean coal technology. But the fact remains that a key technology the government claims will cut emissions from coal-fired power stations in Australia exists only as a prototype. It's a single-cylinder diesel engine sitting in a Newcastle shed waiting for the next round of funding. Industry and government have kicked in $9 million to fund further trials. Even in the middle of deep budget cuts to the CSIRO, Jim Smithen thinks this program is worth supporting.
So this area of research isn't a particularly large part of our research, and particularly while there is such high potential and the interest of stakeholders is quite high, more broad than any one company, then we should make sure that we don't sell it short in the short term.
It might be slim pickings now, but their eyes are on a bigger prize, a slice of the billions in funding available under the Emissions Reduction Fund. John White.
Now, when these DICE engines are commercially available and energy electricity generators decide to install them incrementally into the grid, these projects using this new technology will reduce CO2 emissions dramatically, and they will be able to make a bid into the Emissions Reductions Fund reverse auctions and supply carbon credits and obtain some extra revenue.
White said CSIRO modelling showed such funding could amount to hundreds of millions of dollars a year. Energy consultant Bruce Mountain says the direct injection carbon engine won't really reduce carbon emissions.
Yes, it is lower emission than building an equivalent old brown coal station. But who's going to build that? Surely if there's a calculation of the emission abatement, it's against modern equivalent alternatives. And alternatives exist at lower cost with no emissions or much lower emissions. So I don't know in what sense it would qualify as an emission reduction.
Bruce Mountain says rolling out large new coal-fired diesel engines for power makes no sense. There is already a surplus of generating capacity, and based on his analysis of forecast cost figures given to the government, the technology is neither cheap nor clean.
Its sole gain is that, at least at face value, it's able to extract fuel at a possibly lower cost than gas in future, which if the objective of the plant is to operate as a baseload generator or for a long period of time, would on operating costs make it cheaper than gas. But not when you factor in the fact you have to pay back the capital. If the capital cost is a lot higher, what matters is the long-run cost of electricity. And on that, it doesn't appear to be cheaper, certainly, than modern black coal. It may be cheaper than large-scale gas if gas prices turn out to be higher. But kind of so what? Wind and solar and customer demand shifting is a lot less expensive than that. And private investors are, I would think, going to choose the cheapest available source of generation.
Bob Burton says there's a mismatch between the promise held out by technology companies like Ignite and their ability to deliver.
The track record of Ignite, and it's common to a lot of these other small companies, is it's a small company to start with. So the fact that we don't have major coal companies pursuing these technologies tells us a lot, because major coal companies don't think this technology is worth investing in. It's not going to give them significant rates of return. All of these small companies rely on hyping a technology to deliver a future benefit, and then hoping that they can either find private investors or wangle grants out of governments. And the history of Ignite, I mean, its finances make a pretty sorry story. In the last three financial years that it's lodged returns with the Australian Securities Investment Commission, they've lost in the order of just over $41 million. And in the most recent annual report, the auditor attached a note raising doubts about whether, in fact, the company would still be a going entity in 12 months' time just because it didn't have substantial financial resources to draw on. Now, that was before it got a $20 million government grant, but the very fact that the company was so financially precarious should have been a red flag for the federal and state governments before they gave it $20 million.
That's the nature of technology development, John White says. You raise the money for research, then you spend it.
as we need money, we go to investors and raise the equity to further develop our technology.
Are you relying on grant funding?
No. Grant funds tend to provide about 10% of our funding.
Have you got enough money to really see this project through?
You could ask that question of us every year for the last 8 years. And every time you ask that question, I would give you the same answer, that as we need the money, we raise the money for the next stage of our development. You never raise too much more than you need for the next stage because it sits idly in the bank.
Energy analyst Bruce Mountain can't see why projects like the direct injection carbon engine should get public funding.
It's really hard to see the case for that. I don't know what the public policy objective would be. If it's to find a way to exploit Victoria's brown coal, then the promised technologies must offer much better gain than is apparent with this. Just level pegging with alternative black coal technology, it's hard to see why that justifies public funding.
Ted Pickering says whether it's super coal, ultra clean coal or micronized refined coal, there are some fundamental challenges to demineralising coal on a commercial basis.
My reservations are very similar in all of those super coal, if you like, programs. And that is that the amount of energy you need to apply to a coal to grind it sufficiently finely enough to either chemically or physically remove the non-combustible material from the coal. And the difficulty of those processes working in a favourable way combine to make it very, very difficult indeed in terms of the engineering and in terms of the cost for that to be an economical proposition.
In March, Pickering wrote a 140-page report to the chairman of the CSIRO outlining his concerns with these clean coal research programs. After ordering an internal review and briefings for Pickering, the CSIRO has declined his request for an independent investigation.
There are a whole range of concerns that I have about the process. All of them are engineering, scientifically based concerns. I've not been provided with one skerrick of evidence that would suggest why I'm wrong. I'm just simply told I'm wrong. The history of these programs, to my mind, speaks for itself.
Pickering's complaint raises important questions about why the CSIRO ended up in a long-running partnership with a company whose chairman, Travis Duncan, was later found to be corrupt by ICAC. In lending its name to this clean coal research, the CSIRO delivered a huge commercial advantage to White Industries and its affiliates.
It is my strong view that none of this could have occurred without the imprimatur of the CSIRO.
Back in the Hunter Valley, Bev Smiles is surrounded by enormous coal mines that are swallowing up the district.
The mining companies are the largest landowners between the village of Yulin, which it doesn't have any private owners left in it, all the way down to Bylong and the infamous Mount Penny exploration licence area, where the same directors that were involved in this winning this Malaban exploration licence were so closely involved with Eddie Obeid and the Mount Penny exploration licence, which went through ICAC. So from the local perspective, we've seen the same set of people just working their way through the valley, following the coal seam and making a fortune out of it, while the rest of us are putting up with noise, dust, loss of our neighbours, hundreds of coal trains. It's just changed the dynamic of the region. They're now, you know, multi-millionaires, if not billionaires, and the rest of us are feeling quite done over.
And the clean coal just never seems to eventuate.
No, there's no clean coal, and all of the money that's been poured into various aspects of clean coal, geosequestration, this briquette proposal, there's a whole range of things that have been called clean coal, and nothing's come of it. It's certainly not cheap, so it's been a great waste of taxpayers' money, at the same time as the people that have been shopping it around have just made millions and millions of dollars out of selling dirty coal.
Background Briefing's coordinating producer is Linda McGuinness. Research by Anna Whitfeld. Technical operator this week is Louis Mitchell. Our executive producer is Wendy Carlisle, and I'm Paddy Manning.
Later this year, Australia will take over as the chair of the G20, the grouping of the world's 20 biggest and most populous economies.
The G20 claims to be the preeminent steering committee on global finance, yet excludes 174 nations.
There is no objective criterion to decide why some countries should be in the G20 and why some countries should not be.
Representative body or exclusive club? You can download this Rear Vision from the RN website.